You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 227.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. One of the great things about starting this podcast and doing this podcast with you every week is that I feel like I get to learn something new every week. But, sometimes I try to, I don't always have the infinite all the time in the world. So sometimes I try to get away with a quick show on a topic that I already know something about. So I kind of sit down and I tell myself, all right, let's do a little research. We'll do a 20-minute show. You already know most of this stuff. Just turn on the microphone and get going. But I was trying to do that this week, but no, it didn't work out that way. Instead, today I went down an entire rabbit hole on an issue that we've talked about this before on the program. We've talked about OpenAI. We've talked about large language models. We've talked about all of the drama within Google AI. But today we're going to talk about the release of an AI agent from Google called Gatto AI. I don't know if that's a reference to cat AI or what it's doing, but this has caused a bit of a stir in the on Twitter, on the in the AI press, as we call it. And so I did a little research today, and I'll tell you a little bit about my thoughts on it. Like some of my shows, I'm going to raise more questions than have answers about exactly what Gatto is and what it can do. But people tend to like that. People tend to like when I say, hey, I research these issues. These are kind of tough questions. And so what are the important things that we should be focusing on? So, all right, let's go. Let me sort of bring you up to speed on what's going on. Google's DeepMind, their AI lab, they recently released an AI agent called Gatto AI, and there is a lot being said about it. The hype surrounding it is that it approaches human-level intelligence and that they have cracked the ability to finally achieve general artificial intelligence. More on that later. And what is this elusive general artificial intelligence we're after? Today, we're going to take a quick look at what Gatto AI is, how it works, what it does, and what's been said about it. And hopefully, we'll follow up later in future episodes with more discussions on what this means for the development of artificial intelligence. So first of all, let's start with the abstract of the paper that Google put out about it. First, actually, let me get the title of the paper first. That's kind of important. So why don't I bring that up first? The title of the paper is, it's a nice, simple title, A Generalist Agent. Okay, I like that. And then, of course, they have quite a few, it looks like 20 authors or something like that. The abstract is, inspired by progress in large-scale language modeling, we apply a similar approach toward building a single generalist agent beyond the realm of text outputs. The agent, which we refer to as Gatto, works as a multimodal, multitask, multi-embodiment generalist policy. I'll cut through all the terminology in a bit. Continuing, the same network with the same weights can play Atari, caption images, chat, stack blocks with a real robot arm, and much more, deciding based on its context whether to output text, joint torques, that's like, you know, what to do with the robot, button presses, or other tokens. In this report, we describe the model and the data and document the current capabilities of Gatto. So that's a lot of words, but let's talk a little bit about generalization and what that means. I've worked on systems personally that analyze language, and I've used systems that analyze images, ConvNet, for example, and convolutional neural nets is kind of the go-to way to do that. What they're doing is taking their approach to large language models, which have been all the rage recently, and training deep neural networks and a few other techniques I'll get to in a minute, and making it generic so that it works with all of these tasks, whether it's robotics, video games, or good old-fashioned text analysis and image analysis. So already we're getting some insights into their approach. While some systems might be as good as possible at one specific thing and gather as much data as possible on that thing, Gatto tries to be good at a wide variety of things And then essentially they reuse the technique that it's learned on each one to aid the others because they share the same model. So it's called multimodal, not multi-model, it's one model, multimodal. That term is kind of hard to suss out sometimes. So there's kind of two ways to analyze multimodal. There's this idea in statistics called the mode of a data. You know, in school, you often learn, well, there's the mean, there's the median, and there's the mode. And the mode is the most likely data point. So for example, if, you know, what's the most likely score in let's think of some low scoring game like hockey. Maybe the most likely score in hockey or soccer is zero. You know, for any given team and any given game, but it's certainly not the average score because the average score is going to be higher than zero, and it's probably not the median score either because. Well, it can't be unless more than 50% of endings are zero, then it would be the median score. Otherwise, the median score is going to be harder. So it's like okay, there's the most. But if you're working with continuous data, and you have kind of a probability curve that looks kind of like a bell curve, the top of that curve is considered the mode. So sometimes you have multimodal data, and which you have a bunch of different bumps in it, and you're like, you could identify the top of each bump of, okay, those are different modes of the data, and they're kind of measures of centrality as to where a lot of the data points kind of stick to. And those are that kind of data, that kind of multimodal data, you could say has local maximums of data, where, you know, you have certain areas in the data set where you're like, hey, I see a cluster over here. And if I go in any direction, I see less of a cluster, less of a density of data. So those are often good candidates to say, hey, we're going to split this data into different classifications. And so this mode over here, this bump is one group, and this bump over here is a different group. Another way to analyze multimodal is that it could be that there are different modes of doing things. Like there's image mode, there's video game mode, there's robotic mode, that kind of thing. So I kind of wonder which one they're going for here. But open question, are those kind of similar meanings? I kind of feel like, and I don't know if the word mode or the name mode actually has anything to do with a mode as in like a state of things, but I think in this case, they end up kind of converging onto a similar meaning, which is very interesting. So in terms of what they're doing, this is a sign of progress and also a sign of scale, given that they're coming out of this. It means that they've gone a step above in the generalization ladder than has been done before. So they're not just reusing language models to learn different languages or to learn different dialects of languages, but they're reusing outputs from language models to learn image models and to learn robotic models and things like that. So that's a step above in generalization. And it also means that they have enough data and resources to do it. So in other words, they're getting big tech, getting bigger and bigger, putting all this money into Google research. So a few interesting things about this. First, about the model itself, before I get into all the controversy around it. We're dealing with sequential data here, so there's certainly something very common, for example, for language, where each word comes in sequence, and you can use the previous words to try to predict the next word. You can't predict the next word that someone is going to say exactly, of course, but you have an idea of what types of words might be coming in terms of grammar, and given the context, you might be sort of have an idea of where someone is going with something. You almost do it in your head, and you think in your head of what someone is going to say. You might get the word you expect or one of the few words that you expect, or you might get a completely unexpected word. Our human response to an unexpected word kind of parallels the machine response to an unexpected word. A human response could be confusion, could be laughter. It's a good way of generating humor is when you give the opposite word or a completely different word than what the person is expecting. But it has to be kind of an expected, unexpected word. It can't be a complete, nonsense where, oh, okay, now this person is just, they started talking and now they're just talking gibberish. But in the humor sense, it has to be they started talking and they sort of said something that flipped what I expected on its head. So if there's confusion, then what do? We might try to figure out what's going on. Maybe the speaker made a mistake. Maybe the speaker did not make a mistake, but maybe we need to learn something new that we didn't know before. So that's the idea of something being surprising or something being a very low probability event. And that's the track that Gatto will take. It specifically looks for areas in the data on which it places low probability. You know, that's, you know, that's using something called transformers. That's kind of encoding, quote, surprise. And, you know, they try to train harder on those data that are surprising without sacrificing what's already learned. So that's something that's very common in successful machine learning. You know, it's used, you know, for example, in terms of some of the most successful kind of basic ML toolkit is gradient boosted trees, where you're constantly building these decision trees and then looking at where it fails, and it'd be like, okay, that's surprising. Let me try to build another decision tree that sort of focuses on that on those situations where my current model fails. And so this is one of the building blocks of Gatto that is specifically talked about in these articles. Also on the sequential data, rather than each word or image fragmented and getting studied by the neural net directly, it appears from my quick reading that there's kind of a separate system for embedding these into a vector space, or in layman's terms, turning these things into a list of numbers that's more useful to the algorithm than the data as is, which, by the way, is also a list of numbers. You know, a word is a list of numbers in terms of each letter representing a number, and an image is a list of numbers in terms of a list of pixels. But these kind of vector embeddings sort of turn it into a different list of numbers that's actually a little bit more connected to the meaning of these things versus the literal, you know, digital data that's coming in. So this is the best and most well-studied way of representing large-scale data, although I personally have an aesthetic preference for trying to categorize data like words into a more human-readable and kind of a sensible way. In other words, like, you know, is there a way we can encode the actual meaning of the word versus just put it into a vector and say, hey, this vector represents the meaning, even though, you know, some of these components of the vectors, you know, might have no kind of understandable meaning, but it's just the algorithm is placing things together that look similar. Perhaps in the future, both systems will be reconciled, but, you know, I have to admit that these vector embeddings are currently very successful. So Nando de Feitas, and I apologize if I pronounce that wrong, he's a research director at DeepMind, so one of the developers, he posted on Twitter that he thinks, quote, the game is over in terms of finding general AI. So we have to go over a few things. Why did he write this? This is in response to an article, so we have to get into that article. And what's his bio, and what exactly did he tweet along with this? So first of all, let's talk about the article that he is responding to. He thinks that that their team is on the cusp of AGI, and he's responding to a Next Web article that was about DeepMind when it came out, entitled DeepMind's Astounding New Gatto AI Makes Me Fear Humans Will Never Achieve AGI, General Intelligence. This article says it's arguably Gatto is the most impressive all-in-one machine learning kit the world has seen yet. It says that Gatto is basically taking the same approach of large language models as used by, for example, GPT-3 and OpenAI, huge data, huge model, basically a giant brute force, and applying it to other areas besides language. So just stopping there, from my point of view, and from the point of view of the author, it sounds like there's value in that. So I don't see anything wrong. And the author, who is Tristan Green, agrees this is going to make a lot of money for Google. This could be a very successful product, business success. But he does add that Gatto and GPT-3 are no more viable entry points for artificial general intelligence than the above-mentioned virtual assistants. He says its ability to perform multiple tasks is more like a video game console that can store 600 different games, then it's like a game you can play 600 different ways. It's not general AI. It's a bunch of pre-trained narrow models bundled neatly He adds that's not a bad thing if that's what you're looking for, but there's simply nothing in Gatto's accompanying research paper to indicate this is even a glance in the right direction for AGI, artificial general intelligence, much less a stepping stone. At some point, the goodwill and capital that companies such as DeepMind and OpenAI have generated through their steely-eyed insistence that AGI was just around the corner will have to show even the tiniest of dividends. So, he seems pretty clear. How do we evaluate a statement like this, that Gatto is not AGI? Sometimes that's very difficult to suss out. And I think we sometimes have to take a step back and say, well, how do we evaluate this? How do we measure this? So just like when we had our discussions on this show about whether we can say that a model actually understands what it's doing or understands language versus merely statistically memorizing it, is there a difference? I suspect we can make that distinction, but it's hard to put into writing in practice. So I don't think that it's hard to say that evaluate what he's saying, that this is not AGI on its own term. But I also don't think that we can rely on the people who created Gatto. They probably want to believe they are on the path to AGI. Almost all machine learning researchers want to believe that. I know I certainly do. They probably know more about AI than most people in the world. But they are also a source of a bias source of marketing their own product. So now I also want to mention, before we get into the response, I want to mention a New Scientist piece that was written after this back and forth between the Next Web and Google employees. And that's from New Scientist. New Scientist has an article titled, "Is DeepMind's Gatto AI Really a Human-Level Intelligence Breakthrough?" Subtitled, DeepMind has released what it calls a generalist AI called Gatto that can perform 600 tasks, but does this mean it is truly intelligent? By Matt Sparks. So I like this particular piece because he talks about how we even define general intelligence, which is obviously, without asking this question, we're totally lost. So it turns out, and we knew this, and all the listeners of this show knew this, that it's not even clear how to define general artificial intelligence. So here's what he writes in New Scientist. Outside science fiction, AI is limited to niche tasks. It has seen plenty of success recently in solving a huge range of problems, from writing software to protein folding and even creating beer receipts. But individual AI models have limited specific abilities. A model trained for one task is little use for another. Which, of course, now that we have this general model, we're saying, no, these are connected. Continuing, AGI is a term used for a model that can learn any intellectual task that a human being can. Gary Marcus at U.S. software firm Robust.ai says the term is shorthand. It's not a single magical thing, but roughly, we mean systems that can flexibly, resourcefully solve problems that they haven't seen before and do so in a reliable way. So he mentions later on, what are some tests for AGI? Alan Turing's, the Turing test is a good example. Alan Turing famously suggested that the AI should have to pass as human in a text conversation. Steve Wozniak says that he'll consider AGI to be real if it can enter a random house and figure out how to make a cup of coffee. Other proposed tests are sending an AI to university and see if it can pass a degree, or testing whether it can carry out real-world jobs successfully. All of those, by the way, have their problems. That's why nobody says, I found the answer. All of those are kind of hand-waved. Well, look, I mean, random house and figure out how to make a cup of coffee. That's very difficult because it has to know where the kitchen is. It has to know where the coffee machine is, what a coffee machine. It has to be a full robot. Honestly, if you just see a robot that does just that, but really can't figure much out, is that AGI? I don't know. Or are we claiming that the development of such a robot would presuppose AGI because it's such a difficult problem? I think a lot of problems are like that. So maybe it's true. My favorite quote comes from Jan LeCun, who actually was my former professor at NYU in this article. He writes, Jan LeCun, chief AI scientist at Facebook's owner Meta, says there is no such thing because even humans are specialized. In a recent post, he said that a human-level AI may be a useful goal to aim for, where AI can learn jobs as needed like a human would, but that we just aren't there yet. We still don't have a learning paradigm that allows machines to learn how the world works like human and many non-human babies do. He wrote, the solution is not just around the corner. We have a number of obstacles to clear, and we don't know how. One of the driving forces behind the current success of AI research is scale. More and more computer power is being used to train ever larger models on increasingly large sets of data. The discovery that simple scaling up provides such power is surprising, and we are yet to see any signs that more power, more data, and larger models won't keep providing more capable AI. But many researchers are skeptical that this will lead to a conscious or even general AI. So I honestly don't know if it's that surprising that more data leads to more impressive models, although maybe the rate at which it does is surprising. But, you know, does that scale infinitely? Can you just keep scaling up your data? You know, big data is good. Bigger data is better. Does that mean that we just, the future is always just trying to get more and more just larger and larger data sets? Does this scale infinitely until we reach human level intelligence? Or is there something else our brains are doing? Because, you know, we don't really have infinite data available to ourselves when we're learning. So shouldn't you be able to learn with less data? And isn't that more of a sign of scale? So I'm going to continue with the article. Nando De Freitas, DeepMind, tweeted that the game is over when Gato was released and suggested that achieving AGI was now simply a matter of making AI models bigger and more efficient and feeding more training data in it, but others aren't so sure. Marcus says Gato was trained to do each and every one of the tasks it can do, and that faced with a new challenge, it wouldn't be able to logically analyze and solve that problem. These are like parlor tricks, he said. Parlor tricks, by the way, sorry to cut out from my reading, as I am often do. Parlor trick is definitely a term that I've heard applied to AI a lot, and it's often applied to statistical models. Statistical models where sometimes efficiently statistics that are advanced enough start to look like magic, but those are maybe called parlor tricks, and I think that's a sign of saying, hey, yes, the statistical model looks like magic, but it's not really getting what it's doing, and that's going to make it harder for it to analyze or to generalize. So Marcus says, these are like parlor tricks. They're cute. They're magician's tricks. They're able to fool unsophisticated humans who aren't trained to understand these things, but that doesn't mean they're actually anywhere near artificial general intelligence. Oliver Lemon at Heriot-Watt University in Edinburgh says the claim that the game is over is inaccurate and that Gato is not AGI. By the way, the original post on Twitter doesn't claim that Gato is AGI either. It just claims that this is the way to get there if we just scale this up. Lemon writes, these models do really impressive things. However, a lot of the cool examples you see are cherry-picked. They get exactly the right input to lead to impressive output. So, what has Gato achieved? I'm just going to read the last section of this article because I think almost all of this article is great. It's a short article, but it's got a lot of good information in this. Good job on this with the New Scientist. Even DeepMind's own scientists are skeptical of the claim being made by some about Gato. David Pao, a staff research scientist at DeepMind, tweeted, I genuinely don't understand why people seem so excited by the Gato paper. They took a bunch of independently trained agents, then amortized all of their policies into a single network. That doesn't seem in any way surprising. But Lemon said the new model, and others like it, are creating surprisingly good results. And that, and I'd like to know what surprisingly good results means. And that training an AI to accomplish varied tasks may eventually create a solid foundation of general knowledge on which more adaptable model could be based. I'm sure deep learning is not the end of the story, he says. There'll be other innovations coming along to fill in some gaps that we currently have in creativity and interactive learning. All right. So let's now return to the tweets from Google employee Nando De Freitas. It's very simple. It's just two tweets I want to read. He was responding to all of these comments saying, like, this is not that impressive. This is not general AI. Or actually, they're kind of saying it is impressive, but it isn't general AI. De Freitas writes, my opinion, it's all about scale now. The game is over. It's about making these models bigger, safer, compute efficient, faster at sampling, smarter memory, more modalities, innovative data. Solving these scaling challenges is what will deliver artificial general intelligence. Research focused on these problems, for example, S4 for greater memory, is needed. Philosophy about symbols is not. Symbols are tools in the world, and big nets have no issue creating them and manipulating them. So, interestingly enough, he does wade into what's called the symbolic wars. Can you believe there are so many wars that go on? Like, you know, not real wars, but metaphysical war, you know, like Bayesian versus frequentist, and now we have symbolic versus statistical. That's just, we could probably do a whole episode on the symbolic wars. Maybe I'll write that down. Maybe we'll get into it. But essentially, right now, statistical machine learning is kind of at its height. It's almost seemed to have won the symbolic wars, but there are still machine learning techniques that are based on manipulating symbols rather than, you know, doing kind of these vector embeddings. Pedro Domingo, for example, he's the author of the Master Algorithm, who has researched many different forms of AI. He would disagree with this and say that, you know, he thinks that symbolic representation will make a comeback. Symbolic representation versus vector representation. We'll come back to that. I'm not sure how much I have to say on that today. So, Freitas is the expert, and how can he be wrong? Well, always be skeptical of a scientist who says that their approach is the only approach for solving a problem and that the answer is going to be bigger budgets, bigger machines, bigger teams, bigger everything. Yes, that's scale in a sense. And sometimes you have a kind of a small prototype of a product that works and you can see, hey, if we scale this up with lots of funding, it'll work. But it's also kind of failing to scale. It's failing to do more with less, which is often a source of innovation as well. So when I say be skeptical, I'm not saying he's wrong by any objective count, but we need more evidence. Also keep in mind, and this is kind of an aside, that many of these researchers seem to have an ideological agenda, and the more you read their papers and their bios, the more it becomes clear. Freitas, for example, he has prominently displays his pronouns in his bio and all of his political affiliations, as do just about all the researchers at Google. And this ideology permeates all of their research. I'm not saying it's bad research. I'm not saying there's all wrong stuff in it, but it's permeated with their ideology. One example of that is the paper on their language data set, and I'll link to that on Archive. It's called Scaling Language Models, Methods, Analysis, and Insights from Training Gopher, which I guess is another large language model. And this has about 1,000 authors on it. It looks like we're just proliferating with authors. I mean, how much, if you're one of like a billion authors that wrote something, how much did you actually write? I mean, I guess they just put the whole team on there. All right, well, that's... I wonder if you could kind of separate who's the authors versus who's the team on a paper. It probably seems like a reasonable thing to do rather than, because you kind of want to know who wrote it versus who worked on it. But nope, everybody pile on in the author sections. Anyway, that's an aside. that's not anywhere related to the point that I'm trying to make, but it's just kind of funny. The goal is of this paper, so... this paper is talking about how they trained a language model, which is related to what Gatto is doing. And the goal is to train on a diverse array of English language examples. Good idea. They want different contexts. So, for example, they have some from Wikipedia, some from emails, some from Twitter. They have different dialects. People speak English in different ways. Again, great idea. Diversify the data. Then they start talking about toxicity. Okay, so that's related to spam. That's related to unwanted content on Twitter and that kind of thing. They're very focused on preventing toxic language. Okay, that seems to be... Look, I did that at Foursquare. I had I trained models that were spammy. I trained models to find tips that were spammy. I trained models to find tips that were used in incendiary language, but they seem to be put an incredible amount of weight on this problem. Okay. But then they start pairing it into biased language, not biased data sets, like I was talking about in my paper. And they actually talk about that too, because they, they're trying to not have a biased data set by gathering all sorts of different dialects, and all sorts of different examples of English. But they sort of segue into it, into biased language. And I it almost seems like they kind of take one topic, which is good to talk about, and conflate it with another one, which is like, okay, essentially bad language. We don't want people using this language because it's biased. They have a very specific opinion on how people should talk about issues, how people should use gender, how people should talk about social issues, and what people should, what words people should use to describe things. And they want to make sure that this opinion is represented in this model. And they don't talk about it directly, but I know a lot of this is motivated by the idea that they're going to correct people's language and kind of sort of use their AI to become the thought police, which they see as building a better world. So looks like it's sort of jarring that the top research in this field is dominated in this way, but that's where we are. They kind of have the tools to make themselves into supervillains at some point. So that's where we are. It's concerning. I don't know what to do about it. If you have any ideas, let me know. I wish I could say I'm working on a competitor here, but I'm just a guy starting a programming language in numap.ai right now. It doesn't have any of the scale, which, you know, I hope I eventually start to do symbolic learning and then finally statistical learning, but it'll be a while. But I'm guessing it'll be a different domain than this. I actually liked what Jan LeCun had to say, which I hope is right, that there's room for many different kinds of AI because humans themselves specialize and AI itself will specialize as well. So it's great to build general AIs, and then maybe we incorporate those ideas across the marketplace of machine learning research, and then systems will kind of specialize from there. So that's kind of the primer on what's going on with Gatto and Google Research and the images around this. I hope it was helpful. More questions than answers, I know. What do you think? Let's talk about this on our locals, maximum.locals.com. If you want to weigh in, looking forward to hearing what you guys think about this. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support the Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week. Feel the power.